In today's gospel, instead of the longer, more involved parables of the past few weeks, we get a series of fast-paced snapshots with little interpretive support. From the mustard seed to the master of the household, all in 10 short verses. The images Jesus chose would have been familiar everyday images to the people to whom he was speaking. And this familiarity contributes to perhaps the greatest revelatory power of the parables, what C.S. Lewis called the sudden perception of incongruity between the remarkable and the unremarkable, between the comfortable familiarity of the mustard bush and the work of the fishermen, and what their presence in the parables reveals about the realities of the gospel. Douglas Webster calls the parables Jesus's friendly, subversive speech, like the scandalous God of our collect this morning. And I love what this phrase suggests about the simultaneous accessibility and inscrutability of these images. Much of the incongruity for a first century listener may have been in the very accessibility of the images themselves. Jesus wasn't describing the kingdom of heaven using comparisons to things of the elite, but to some of the very basics of life for the ordinary person. Mustard plants might not have had the cachet of the cedars of Lebanon, but they were present in the common landscape, and they're not even as something particularly noteworthy. Bread was a basic staple of life and hospitality, and fishing towns well knew the work of dragging laden nets in and keeping what was life-giving and throwing away what was not. And yet Jesus uses these very ordinary images to talk about extraordinary things. He's playing with the familiar in order to lead his listeners to a different way that the world could work, to a new logic. In some ways, the images of these parables are even more familiar to us, not because we see mustard bushes in every other yard, nor because we make our own bread necessarily, though some of us do, or fish for our livelihoods, but because we've heard them so often. From when we were children in children's books, we've seen these stories and these images. To the point that even the connection between these mundane things and the extraordinary kingdom of heaven seems unremarkable to us. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. Of course. It has power beyond its size. Its life-giving growth is exponential. We know. For us, we might have to dig a little deeper to find the kinds of incongruities that can open us up to new possibilities. Dig deeper, or sometimes just keep reading. As for me at least, things start to take a turn with these other images in this omnibus bill of parables. The Ottawa crowd. As I read on, by the time we get past the treasure and pearl stories and the gnashing of teeth, and Jesus asks, "Have you understood all this?" I'm answering with a bewildered, "Not really, no, sorry," and taking reassurance from the fact that the crowd, even the disciples, did not always answer such questions with the yes they did in this passage. Why did the man hide the treasure in the field that wasn't his to begin with? Did the field belong to someone else before he bought it? These are the questions that I'm thinking about. How did the merchant support himself once he had sold all but one pearl? Reflecting on these places of incongruity for myself I found in these passages this week, I ended up thinking a lot about the assumptions we make about the way the world functions, the norms and conventions that shape our lives, communities, and world. When the actions of the pearl merchant doesn't make sense to me, or I worry about his retirement, it is perhaps because they are operating according to a different logic. I often do an activity in my classes where we explore a variety of medieval maps. Historical maps are great sources for understanding world building, as they very clearly represent and depict how their makers saw the worlds they lived in. I start the activity with little explaining on my part in order to give students space to start to make sense of these world maps and to grapple with what is familiar and unfamiliar in them themselves. We look, as we see right now, at the busy and beautiful Hereford Mapamundi, where time and space are both represented, where Jerusalem sits at the center of the world, and Eden sits past Asia in the east, where the size of cities corresponds to their importance, not their material size, and whose world includes the golden fleece of Greek myth, depicted right along with the Exodus and contemporary cities, and elephants and unicorns alike. We also look at the Tabula Rogeriana, which you can also see, an extensive atlas that depicts that same world and was commissioned by the Norman King of Sicily, Roger II, and completed by the Almoravid geographer, Muhammad al-Idrisi. The tabula now survives only in paper, but was once engraved on a giant silver disc as a showpiece in the Norman King's royal palace. Every year, what my students always find the most disorienting aspect of these maps is that neither is oriented north-south, as the most common convention today. The Hereford map follows the conventions of most medieval Christian maps and is oriented with the east at the top, where we would put north. While the Tabula Rogeriana follows the typical medieval Arabic orientation of the south on the top. Our modern Western eyes automatically try to fit the worlds we see into our mapping norms. And when we do that with these worlds, they don't make any sense. It usually takes people some time before they can discern the familiar shapes of Europe, Africa, and Asia on the map. And then all of a sudden, reoriented, it all clicks and the world makes sense. This disorientation is half the point of the exercise because it shakes us out of the belief that our assumptions about the orientation of the world are normative. And it's also really hard. I have had students who were deeply offended to learn about these different medieval conventions and wrote them off as ridiculous because maps are north-south, and that's the end of that. When we don't allow ourselves to experience similar disorienting moments of incongruity in the parables, those moments where the familiar geography of the world is suddenly unrecognizable to us, we can end up trying to force God to fit into our paradigms. Indeed, too often, historically and today, the kingdom of heaven has been invoked by Christians to assert a place of power, wealth, and status for themselves in the world. A place of power and privilege in a kingdom that looks pretty much like any other kingdom or government in the world, but with themselves in charge. In this interpretation of the kingdom of heaven, there is no incongruity, because in this interpretation, the fundamental conventions or paradigm of the kingdom of heaven are made to be the same as those of the world. Where we find incongruity instead, we also find the opportunity to examine our assumptions. How does my logic need to change for the pearl merchant's actions to make sense? Our reading today from Paul's letter to the Romans also reframes the conventions of the world and contrasts them with the orientation of the gospel. By the conventions and terms of his world, Paul's audience was the opposite of conquerors. They were imperial subjects, soon to be suppressed by the empire that defined empires in the Western world for over 2,000 years. They were not particularly legally justified, as they were largely women, slaves, and imperial subjects who were not prioritized by most applications of Roman law. But Paul is stepping outside of these worldly conventions while acknowledging their very real implications and offering a world connected to our own, but not contained by our own. In contrast, we see in the Old Testament reading about Jacob, Leah, and Rachel today, Leah and Rachel's father prioritizes the social conventions of his time over what would be a disruptive love. When Jacob wants to marry his younger daughter because he's in love with her, Rachel's father does the right things by the account of the day and tells him that's not how we do things around here. If you want to marry the second daughter, you have to marry the older one first. The enforcement of this convention, however, would echo through Jacob, Leah, and Rachel's family in resentment, anger, violence, and grief. In contrast, both today's parables and Paul's letter offer a sometimes startling path to seeing the ways in which the fundamental logic of the kingdom of heaven is a logic of love, and the ways in which this logic breaks into our own world. When I stopped to think about where I found myself coming up against the parables of this week and this past month, I found that I was operating under our familiar assumptions, familiar capitalist and consumeristic assumptions. Everything is sellable, and for as much as we think we can get for it. I see this logic inform both big and little decisions in my day-to-day life, not to mention the ways in which we as a society prioritize and reward financial expediency. I recently heard someone on a CBC radio program bemoan the fact that Canadians like Frederick Banting had allowed other countries to monetize insulin, and that Canada had lost out on benefiting from its inventions. Banting, the discoverer of insulin, sold the patent for it to the University of Toronto for a dollar, because he believed that it should belong to the world. But often by the logic of our world, Banting's actions weren't sensible or even correct. And yet, in this one incongruity of many, Paul and the parables remind us that the kingdom of heaven doesn't make good financial sense. Just ask the pearl merchant. And yes, money matters, just like the societal conventions faced by the Christians in Rome mattered. But what if something else mattered more? Reflecting this week in my own life, some of the things I am most grateful for are the result of someone deciding that something else was more important. And not just in big exceptional ways like insulin, though definitely that also. In much smaller day-to-day ways. When we were looking for a place to live after Eli was born, we weren't able to offer the highest bid for what is now our house. If getting the most money for their house had been the seller's top priority, we wouldn't be living where we are today. But for the elderly couple selling the house their children had grown up in, giving it to people who would love it and stay in it was more important. And choosing that something else that was more important changed our lives pretty dramatically. However it plays out in our own circumstances and in our own daily decisions, living according to the logic of the kingdom of heaven means putting love first, even when our first instinct is to read a map north-south. Even when we're angry that a map might not be oriented north-south. These parables challenge us to look at the structures of our lives. What orientation makes our actions, decisions, and lives make sense? Where are the places in our lives and in the Gospels that we become aware of that sudden perception of incongruity? We're invited to continually ask ourselves, how do I live in such a way that someone looking at a map of my life would be able to make sense of it if it were oriented to love?